The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
A few weeks ago, we were exploring in this group the things that we add to our experience that move us in the direction of suffering. And some time ago, maybe about three, four weeks ago, I started talking about the sense of self being something that we add to our experience. And in that conversation, I realized there was so much to say. I thought I would spend another session exploring that topic. What is this sense of self? Actually, one Zen teacher expressed the entirety of our path of practice in terms of studying the self. He said, to study the way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self, or I might say in a different language, to study the self is to realize our illusions about self, our disillusions about self, to disillusion ourselves about the sense of self. And to forget the self is to be awakened by all things. And so I wanted to explore this question of what does it mean to study the sense of self. When we say study the self, we might think, oh, we're studying something. But the teachings, the understanding, is that what we think of as self, which is, it seems so like common sense. It feels like there's a me here. It seems so obvious to us that there's a me here. But when we start to look at that, what do I think I am? What is this sense of self? It quickly begins to be kind of, you know, like quicksand. It's not something we can actually pin down. And the Buddha pointed to this. He said, you know, what we think of as self, or my understanding of the teaching around this is that what we think of as self is not what is actually happening. That what we identify as self, what we call self, is actually not a thing, not an entity, but rather a process. And so the sense of self is a kind of a continual stream, a continual process that is running in our experience, and that we misattribute a thingness to that process. And so, what is it that we think of as self? If we just start reflecting on what is it that we call self, because the sense of self that doesn't actually stand up under much scrutiny. So what is it that you think of? What is it that you call self? I'm asking you. So I just want some senses from you. What is it that you think of when you, or what is it that you feel? Yeah, I'll repeat them. Familiar attitudes towards things. Okay, so familiar attitudes towards things. The body.
Or people have a construction by other people.
So what other people think of us.
We imagine the self building up that sort of image.
So from other people we get an image of ourselves. Yes, so from feedback, yep. Mm-hmm. Other thoughts. Awareness of consciousness, that's a pretty subtle sense of self. Yeah. An accumulation of experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Personality.
How we relate to others.
And there seems, in underlying all of this, often is some kind of feeling of stability, right? There's a sense that this is how I relate to others. This is the personality. And so it's not just, I mean, you know, when we say these things like accumulation of experiences, how I relate to others, as we reflect on that, we can see it's constructed, it's conditioned, it's dependent on what's happening in the world. And so there, you know, even with just a little bit of reflection, we can see how that sense of self isn't so much a thing, but it's more related to conditions. So how we relate to others, for instance, you know, it's not just one way, right? I mean, we relate to other people based on our relationship with them. So, you know, parents we relate to in one way, children we relate to in another way, a teacher we relate to in another way, a boss we relate to in another way. It's like we have these different identities that congeal around our relationships. And yet it's like, you know, it's right there, even right there, is a pointer to this understanding that there's not a solid me there. But somehow our minds just kind of skim over that and still attribute kind of some kind of solidity or thingness to who I am. Even with the evidence that there's kind of this different patterns that we have with different people, different relationships. And then, you know, even relating to the body actually at one point, the Buddha said something like, in terms of, you know, identifying with the sense of self, the body is the thing that makes the most sense because the body's around for a longer period of time. You know, and yet, you know, even now we know that every cell in our body is replaced. I think some of the neurons stay, you know, some of the neurons stay for our lives. But even in the brain, there's more change than scientists originally thought. Something like every 10 years or every 7 years, our bodies are replaced. That reminds me of a joke that I heard a stand-up comedian do. He said, he came on with an axe. He said, "This is George Washington's original axe with which he chopped down the cherry tree." He said, "Well, but the handle actually got replaced because it wore out. And the head, too, had to be replaced. But it occupies the same space." That's what's happening in our bodies. It's occupying the same space, in a way. So this sense of self, you know, as we start to look at it, there's some key pieces, and one of them is this sense of stability, a sense of solidity, a sense of occupying the same place, in a way. There's this sense, that sense is there. And so that's something to explore, actually. Something, at one point in my practice, I began looking at whenever there was a sense of solidity, whenever any aspect of my experience was felt like, yeah, that's solid, I started looking at it. What is it that I'm taking to be solid or there? And very quickly, especially in the field of being on retreat, very quickly it's proven that that thing that is solid is actually composed of many changing conditions, changing experience, conditioned experience. It's not a thing. It's more like it's a process. Another analogy for the sense of self might be a rainbow. A rainbow is dependent on conditions. It's dependent on a certain kind of moisture in the atmosphere. It's dependent on there being sun, so clouds not present, even as there's rain in the sky. And it's dependent on the position of the observer with respect to the sun and the moisture. It's got all of these pieces that come together. And then the rainbow is present. We can see that rainbow. But we know that if the sun goes behind a cloud, the rainbow disappears. If the rain stops, the rainbow disappears. If we change our orientation to the sun, the rainbow disappears. So the sense of self is more like that. It's constructed. And we can see that there's, I mean, with a rainbow, we can understand that there's no way to hold on to it. You know, it's not something we can, like, grab or, you know, say, there's the rainbow. We can see it, and we can see it kind of shift and change even as we watch it, as the conditions shift and change. And so it's not an entity, it's a set of conditions that have come together. And the sense of self is very like that. Another piece that, so there's that feeling of stability that I think is one piece that's very, a sense of stability. You know, I think a lot of that comes from memory. You know, the way our minds work, that we remember things. We remember when we were children what we did, what our relationships were. And so the whole process of memory and our how we've been shaped comes to create that sense of stability, thingness, of this is me. So that's one piece of the sense of self, that feeling of, yeah, I'm here. I remember how it was, you know, 10 years ago, and here I am now, and that was me, and this is still me. So it's kind of related to memory that we create this notion of a sense or an entity, a stable thing. Another piece around the sense of self, I'll see if this one resonates for you, is a feeling of, at least to some extent, being the one who's in control. I am the one who does things. I'm the one who chooses, who decides. So, you know, that's often a feeling of a sense of self. You know, and this actually plays itself out a lot. Especially in our meditation, we can start to see this. Again, we can start to see as we investigate how that idea around control is, that idea of a sense of self being in control, that sense of self having control, is a misattribution. So, for instance, we sit down to meditate, and there may be a sense of me doing this. I'm sitting down. I'm going to meditate. I'm going to pay attention to my experience. And what happens? You know, we get maybe a few breaths, and then the mind wanders. We choose to direct our attention to our breath, and some process happens whereby the mind picks up on something else and gets lost in thought. Did we choose to have the mind wander? Who did that? Who did that wandering? So, you know, if the sense of self is the me who chooses to be present, what is the entity or thing that does the wandering? And even more amazing, actually, is because we can kind of maybe say, well, you know, I got caught by some sound or something, and I got caught by that thought. But even more amazing is that, you know, our mind is lost. It's wandering off in some other world, some other place, and mindfulness returns. Who did that? Again, we attribute a sense of self kind of after the fact. In these cases, it's like, you know, I'm sitting down to meditate, so, you know, that we have the sense of that's me. Then the mind wanders, and when we return from wandering, we attribute the sense of me in that case to the one who was wandering. I got lost in thought, and it was my fault. I didn't control my mind. When my mind wandered, I didn't control it. And so that was me that didn't control the mind wandering. And so after the mind has wandered, when we wake up, we attribute a me to that wandering. And we often judge ourselves for it and struggle over it and suffer over it. The mind wandered. We return into consciousness and then attribute a sense of self to that one who wandered and feel like we should have done differently. Feel bad about ourselves about that. We have constructed an identity around which to suffer. That's what our minds did right there. So the this sense or this this recognition that the sense of self is not what we think it is actually staring us in the face. But the pattern or the habit of thinking that we are, that we have a sense of self, is so strong, it's like it prevents us from recognizing the evidence that's right there, that's pointing to us, that says, this is a process, it's not a thing. Now, the teaching on not self is often, it's confusing because it does feel so much like there is a self, but I want to kind of have a little bit of nuance to this teaching, because the Buddhist teachings don't say there's nothing that that the sense of self is nothing. It more expresses that what we think of as self, there is a process happening. It's not that that process doesn't happen, but that process is not an entity. It's not a thing. If we can recognize, for instance, just in the simple example of the wandering mind while meditating, if we can recognize that as we sit down to meditate, that, okay, the attention, I'm bringing the attention, there is a form of agency in our minds. You know, so that there is a way in which there's a sense that that process that feels like it's connected with that agency can choose something in the present moment. And so that feeling, that kind of feeling, or that sense that there is an agency or a control that can happen, can sit down and choose to pay attention to the breath. And for some period of time, that may be able to be stayed with or connected with. But something will happen. A sound will happen that the attention isn't quite fully present to. A sound of a motorcycle going by, and suddenly the mind is thinking about motorcycles and it's going off. Now, that's simply a process that happens in the mind. There is a process going on. It's not that there's nothing happening. It's just that there's not an entity, a thing there, a me that is constant, unchanging. This is the nuance that the Buddha was pointing to. And so if we can begin to study or get interested in what we take to be me, and why we would do this is exactly for the reason that I just pointed to in that simple example. When we construct a me and believe it to be me, we often will suffer over that. You know, that example, you know, or the mind wanders. We construct the sense that I did that and feel like we should have had control to not do that, and then we suffer over it. So this sense of me having control, this is a big area of suffering, I think, this feeling or this sense of attributing control to a sense of self. Because when we realize, when world intervenes, when experience shows us that we don't actually have ultimate control over what's happening, when we attribute that sense of self to being the one who's supposed to be in control, we feel like we failed. We feel like we, that it's a mistake, that somebody is to blame, or that we're a failure. It's not a mistake when we don't have ultimate control over what's going on in our experience. It's the way it is. And so this is a place or a piece that, as we begin to explore the sense of self and recognize and understand the various ways that we attribute a sense of self, that we can begin to poke holes in those beliefs and see, oh, when the mind wanders and I wake up, it's like, yeah, I did, that happened. Right now, as mindfulness returns, when mindfulness is present again, there is some connection of that agency to presence of mind. And so when mindfulness is present, there can be a sense of choosing. It's okay, I see that the mind got caught up by that storm. And now that I'm present, now that mindfulness has returned, there can be a little bit of choosing. That process of mindfulness connects with the process of agency and can choose something skillful. Maybe not being so caught up in a story or a pattern or an argument or a daydream, but coming back, being with what's here now. When mindfulness isn't present, basically our patterns and our habits are kind of tumbling along based on conditioning. Essentially, one of the ways that I feel that I identify a sense of self is like there's certain patterns or habits, as you kind of I recognize, as you named what you think of as self, you know, ways of being, ways of relating, habits or patterns. Those have been thoroughly conditioned. And when mindfulness isn't present and we're just kind of going on autopilot, those conditions are what are running the show. And so that can be a sense of self in effect, that sense of what we habitually do can feel like our sense of self. So this running on autopilot, though, can be also a way that we get caught, because often when we're running on autopilot and not present with a sense of what's a skillful direction to go, what's a helpful direction to go, when we're running on autopilot, often our habits around wanting and aversion will come to the fore. And so if we're not present, so mindfulness kind of joined with this exploration can help us to both poke holes in the way we think we are identified and begin to help us to make more skillful choices. So mindfulness, too, is a process. You know, the way the whole path unfolds, you know, it's like we're this conditioned system. Our being is a conditioned system. And it has been conditioned in the past based on our families, our cultures, you know, what's happened to us. And that's kind of the direction that a stream is flowing. Another good analogy for the sense of self is a river. You know, it's a river kind of maybe is a little more stable than a rainbow. But still, it too changes. You know, with a river, the river bed. I mean, what do we think of as river? You know, it's like the water itself isn't the river. It's so obvious. You know, you take a bucket of water out of the river. It's like, well, that's not the river. That's just water that's from the river, we would say. And as we know that water is not always there. It's different water every second. So it's not the water that's the river. That water, that flow is continually changing. Sometimes it's more, sometimes it's less. Well, maybe the river bed is the river. Well, you know, if the river bed is dry, we don't call it a river anymore. And two, when there are floods, the course of the river bed can change. And the particles, the sand, the mud, the everything that's the river bottom, that too is being carried downstream, the silt, you know. So it's not a stable thing, although the river bed is a little more stable, like our bodies are more stable. But still, it's a process. So this exploration around this process helps us to see more clearly that what we think of as self is not what we think of. And we also begin to see the ways in which that sense of self contributes to our struggles, our dissatisfaction, our unease, our distress in the world. You know, even senses of self that feel good. You know, it's like I've seen in my own practice this, you know, this sense of self of like, oh yeah, I can do this. I know how to do this. Again, that sense of being in control. This came up in particular on one retreat around meditating. It's like, oh yeah, I'm good at this. I can do this. Maybe I'm even the best meditator here. And so there was a sense of me that was born around that. And that felt good. You know, there's a sense of, yes, I am in control. The feeling of being in control, of having a say over our destiny, is something this being likes. And so there's an attachment to that. There's a sense of, yes, that's the way it's supposed to be. That's right. That's good. It's pleasant. It feels good, that sense of being in control. And so we can identify with that. And yet what happens when, as on this retreat, over and over again, I kind of cycled between these identities. Over and over again, it's proven that, well, no, you're not actually in control of your mind. And, you know, when I saw the mind just going everywhere and unable to stabilize the mind, it's like, well, oh, I guess I'm not a good meditator. I'm a failure at this meditation. And suffering arose. Now, in my own kind of normal mind, I was on retreat at that point, and so I began to recognize that there was a dependence of these two identities. That the identity of feeling like a failure was dependent on that identity of feeling like I was a success. That feeling of failure wouldn't have come up if I hadn't attributed that good meditator to myself. And yet in our normal lives, we feel like what we're supposed to do with our senses of self is that what we're supposed to do is to move more and more in the direction of feeling those good senses of self and not have those uncomfortable senses of self. It's like trying to cut the seesaw in half. It's like, I'm supposed to get rid of these. I'm not supposed to feel like I'm a failure, but I'm always supposed to feel like I'm a success. So that's a misunderstanding, again, around the process that's at work, because those two are connected. You can't cut a seesaw in half. There's always an up and always a down. So the exploration around our senses of self begins to point out that even the ones that we think of as helpful or as good or as that's the way it's supposed to be, that even those create hold the seeds of the conditions for suffering, for dissatisfaction, because this is the way the world is. You know, we don't have ultimate control. We don't have that kind of control. Let me see if there's more. There's a lot more to say. I think I'll talk a little bit about... Well, actually, I'm going to stop and see comments, questions. I've got more to say, but yeah. And use the mic. Pass the mic back.
Comments. Okay. I have two comments. One is I started taking up meditation practice regularly in 2001. Before that, my sense of stability itself had been permanently shattered by getting fairly severe encephalitis, which left me fairly mentally disoriented for about 3 years, and which significantly altered my personality time. When I took a course on American Buddhism at the Graduate Theological Union in 2005, the professor found it kind of comical because I discussed this experience and said that in a way that does not conflict at all with anything you're saying, I was in many ways meditating to regain a sense of stability of self because I had been thrown way off kilter by this encephalitis thing, which had really changed my personality drastically. And I don't know how to explain that the recovery of stability of self is in complete harmony with everything you're saying, but it does make sense to me that it is, because I had to process that instability that I had been taught by the neurological
right,
problems.
Right.
So the professor found that, Verhoeven, he found that very comical, that I was sort of regaining a sense of stability of self by
Let's wait for your second comment. Let me say some things about that.
Yeah, process the instability.
So, yeah, you know, there's... I think part of the reason why a sense of self seems so obvious to us is that it does help us to navigate the insanely changing nature of our world. And so it supports, in some ways it supports us. So there's a reason for it, right? It's not the sense of self is not,
arbitrary.
Yeah, it's not arbitrary. It's a process. I mean, we all share it, right? I mean, it's a human thing that we have this sense of self. So there's an evolutionary reason for that sense of self. It's still so the fact that it's helpful, the fact that it helps us kind of make sense of the incredible changing world of experience doesn't mean that it's a thing, but it means it's a process that our minds use to help navigate the confusing reality of the world. And we misattribute a thingness to it. So that's one piece of it and also the sense of there's actually a psychologist, Jack Engler, actually said that before we begin to dismantle and understand deeply this not self teaching, we really need to have a stable sense of self. So it's not that we are congealing, like the understanding of the sense of self. It is helpful to have a stability of mind and a stability because you know when we're kind of confronted by kind of radical impermanence, it can be very disorienting. And so to have some stability of mind in meeting that radical impermanence helps us to be able to take in that truth of it's not a thing, it's a process. And so what I would say that you were exploring was finding a way to come to a stable sense or a more stable sense of that process of you,
yeah,
so that it could meet the world again.
Yeah. The other thing I was saying is that there are these various evanescent processes in nature that are not a thing, but some of them seem to have more impact than others. Because
have more what than others?
More impact than
more
others
impact,
because
yeah.
The rainbow is something that gives us a tremendous sense of beauty, but even without thinking about all these things, we sort of know it's evanescent in a way. A river is not a stable thing, as you say, but a river nurtures fish, floats boats, and does those things. And then
absolutely.
Then I think all the air molecules in a hurricane probably get replaced every hour or so, much more rapidly than George Washington's axe, but, hurricane picks houses up off the ground and stuff.
And so this is another reason why we attribute thingness, I think, because of the impact that conditions have. And this is why, in terms of our sense of self, it's so helpful to begin to turn the conditions, because, boy, we as human beings have impact too. the concepts, the ideas, the ideologies, the beliefs, all of those are not things. They are constructs of our minds. And boy, do they have an impact. And so, racism, a concept of human mind, it's pretty thoroughly proven that race is not a biological thing. There's nothing that you can point to in that. And so, but boy, the concept of racism is very destructive. And so this points to, you're pointing to certain destructive things and supportive things, right? The river both supports fish and floats boats and can flood and create devastation. And so this is looking at the conditions, right?
That's right.
The conditions are... Yeah, the conditions are varied. So this flow of sense of self can be flowing in a direction that's positive or in a direction that's harmful. And so this is what we do with our practice, is we look at what does it mean to create the conditions for this flow of this process of self to flow in a more helpful direction. And the conditions of sitting in this room is one of the conditions. Hearing the teachings, hearing the Dharma is one of the conditions that gets put into that system. Hearing this puts new information into the system. And the system responds in a certain way from that information. Even this is not self. Even this sitting in this room. What brought you here? Each one of us has so many conditions. I mean, not just this morning. What brought you here this morning? And there's thousands of conditions that brought you each here this morning, and thousands of things that might have happened to keep you from being here this morning. So your sitting in this room is conditioned. The things that brought you to the Dharma are conditioned. It's mind-blowing to understand just how many conditions put this moment together. And so what we explore in our practice is what are the conditions that can help lead that process forward in a way that creates less harm and suffering in the world. And so I think those are great examples, in terms of the conditions, swirling conditions do have an impact. They have a huge impact. It's not if there were no self, if there were no thing, it's like no thing has no impact. But it's not that. It's a process that is present, like the process of the river, the process of the hurricane. And these processes have impact. And so taking responsibility for this process means taking responsibility for the impact that it has. So thank you for those other comments. I'll pass the mic forward.
It was somewhat ironic in the meditation. I had this flow of awareness. Somehow I was reflecting on awareness of arriving here and the awareness of being here. And I just had this flash like, wow, all that thought. It's just like I was picturing myself, and I didn't even drive here, but I was picturing myself driving here. And there's all this thought to control and manage a sense of self so I can feel stable, and how much suffering that was created. And in this flow of being, it's like all that disappears. That efforting constantly to make everything be stable which is impossible. So it was ironic that you spoke about it. Just and I, in the meditation, I was like, there's this sense of tremendous peace. And in terms of stability, and I look at the Buddha there in the selflessness, isn't it also can be the case that in letting go of that or no longer experiencing that identity with the thingliness of self, that then there's this deeper stability in the process. It's like
it's a stability in it's a paradoxical stability.
Right.
It's a paradoxical stability,
yeah.
Because it's not a stability in landing anywhere. It's a stability in understanding that it's
in flowing.
Continually flowing. So it's the mind has to be pretty. And this comes to the consciousness, the identifying with awareness in a way. It's like that too can also be a place of a sense of self. Oh, I'm the one who's just experiencing this flow. And so that's another one to look at, you know. So, you know, it's like we kind of strip back the more obvious kinds of senses of self around relationships and roles and control, and then we come to this place of being, and we can being, I'm the one who's being.
Right, if we try to grasp that, then it becomes the same process.
Any grasping around something creates a constriction.
Right. There is
that's
no,
painful.
Yeah, there is no end to the letting go, apparently.
Yes.
But the stability is just amazing.
Yeah, it's a different kind of stability
compared to that constant process of arguing with life, not, you know, being the way I want it to be.
Well, so that's just it. You know, it's like what this is about is coming into alignment with what's actually true. You know, so much of our lives we are fighting with what's actually true. We're fighting with the truth that impermanence is the nature of life. We're fighting with the truth that unreliability is the nature of life. It's like we're trying to control that unreliability and that it is out of control. So it's when we can come into alignment with that. Like, basically, that alignment with truth is deeply relieving. It can be. And yet, it's so interesting, you know, the teaching around impermanence. You know, we don't think about that being so scary sometimes. You know, it's like you ask anybody, do things change? And it's like, yeah, I mean, you know, everybody knows things change. And people aren't really, you know, terrified. Well, so, I mean, it's not a concept that people are in fear about all the time. It's like, yeah, we know things change. We like it sometimes. We don't like it sometimes. And yet this idea of not self, when people think about it, it often feels kind of scary. It's like, if I'm not who I think I am, then, oh no. What do I have to hold on to, or what do I have to land on? And so that idea, the idea of impermanence is not so scary because we think about it all the time. The idea of not self when it first hits us can be kind of scary and uncomfortable. And yet, as we explore in more depth our experience, the more we come into contact with the truth of impermanence, it's like, whoa. There isn't any place to land. It's like continually falling. It's like, wow, that's kind of unsettling. Even scary. And so as we come into the truth of impermanence in a very visceral way, there's a kind of a fear that comes up, and that's a place that we need to look. Okay, so yes, there's fear is arising. That fear is arising around identifying with wanting things to be stable. But that's a place to look. Oh, there's fear around this impermanent place. When we actually come into the visceral understanding, the understanding of not self, it's a relief. It's not frightening. When we actually have that experience, it's a relief. And again, it's kind of, in some ways, the fear around impermanence is because of that identification with wanting things to be stable. So there's a subtler sense of identification and a sense of self underneath. And as we recognize, there isn't a self. There isn't a sense, the sense of self, there is a sense of self, but it's not what we think it is. Whew, there's such a relief. And that's what you were pointing to. I want to give somebody else an opportunity.
Sure.
Yeah. Is there anybody else who, yeah, over here. Pass the mic over.
I just thought, share, I read, and I can't remember the author because I keep reading all these books and then I forget which book it was. But in describing the process of going to meditation, the author said that your ego may say, can I go along? I want to go along. And I think ego may be another word you might use.
Yeah, ego. Ego is a word that we can use for the sense of self. Yeah.
Okay.
And again, you know, that ego creates issues when we kind of hold to it. Yeah.
Well, I've held on to that image because it puts a smile on my face. I just can't help but smile and say, "No, sorry, ego." you can't go along because the ego wants to say, oh, you're good. You're going to meditation.
And another way to explore that is to say, okay, ego, you can come along and I'm going to know when you're operating. So, okay, oh, you're good. Oh, okay, hi, ego. I see you. You know, because we often can't stop it. You know, that sense of ego, you can't come along for the ride, is yet another sense of self saying what we can and can't do. And so, you know, at some point, and it can be skillful. It's kind of like we can construct different identities that we latch onto that helps us let go of other identities. Like for myself, I definitely attached to the identity of being a meditator that helped me to let go of other less helpful identities, you know, the judging and the comparing and the fixing. And yet at some point, that identity of being a meditator starts to create suffering too. And it's like, okay, this one needs to be seen too. Other comments? Just wait a sec.
Artificial knee.
I will be brief. It's kind of un-Buddhist, but you can empathize with this sensibility without endorsing it. At the end of the musical Camelot, King Arthur says, "We're just waves upon the ocean, but some of us do sparkle. We do sparkle." And that's kind of like, yeah, that's not really the final solution from a Buddhist point of view. You need to reject that too. But you can sort of...
I wouldn't say it needs to be rejected. It needs to be understood.
Yeah, right. Yes,
it
right.
It needs to be understood.
Very good, yeah.
And so the sparkles are conditioned.
Yes, right.
It's just another condition. Yeah. Other thoughts or comments? Let's see if there's anything more in here. So I guess I'll say a couple things about watching this sense of self. What I've seen in my own practice is that it's often not so helpful to try to figure out what sense of self is happening in a moment. It's like, what's happening now? Just, you know, what's obvious about what's happening now? Oh, there's a feeling of contraction. There's a feeling of ease. Oh, there's a feeling of a sense of self. You know, it may be a variety of things. You know, the sense of self is often most obvious when beliefs are challenged, when something happens that proves to us that we're not in control, when the I word is really strong in your mind. That's a time when it may be useful to explore, well, what's happening here? So the sense of self we can start to explore when it's more obvious to us. I don't recommend that you try to figure out what the sense of self is that's happening at any given moment. There's always some sense of self happening. If we are suffering, there is a sense of self happening. If we are in any kind of distress, dissatisfaction, unease, there's a sense of self happening. And yet sometimes what's most obvious is the sense of distress. And so if what's obvious is a feeling of unhappiness or fear or confusion, it's like, okay, that's what's obvious. Let me just be with that feeling of confusion. You don't have to figure out the I that feels confused. Just be with that confusion. In the Buddha's teaching, this process of the sense of self, he's got a whole process that describes the sense of self happening. Conditioned process that describes the sense of self happening. And it's the same process that describes how suffering is created. And so we can watch suffering. If we're watching suffering, if we're watching our minds be confused or fearful or angry, that you're watching the process. Sometimes the sense of self is more obvious, like a sense of, I'm a failure. I'm right. At those times, we can kind of look at that. It's like, oh, I'm a failure. What does it feel like? Often it's got this feeling of like, it's got that stable feeling, right? It begins to feel solid. So notice that. Notice that experience of what does that feel like? What is that experience of feeling like I'm a failure or I'm right? Another exploration under that that's often helpful when you do see a sense of self is to just check in, what kind of beliefs are happening here? What's being believed? Because very often the sense of self is predicated on some belief or other that may not be in our level of consciousness. So that's a question we can drop in. What's being believed here? Like underneath the feeling of I'm a failure might be, you know, a belief like I'm never supposed to fail. I mean, that might be an obvious one. You know, I'm never supposed to fail. It's like sometimes those beliefs reveal themselves as being pretty ridiculous when we actually see them. So that's enough for today. There's always more to say about this topic, but that may be it for a little while. So thank you for your attention.